others versus these properties, et cetera, Brandon S. Osterline, Appellant Counsel, G. Edgar Dawson III, Amy Miles Kowalski, Caitlin E. Martin, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Brandon Osterbein, and I represent the appellants, Francis Hospitality, and Delta Educational Systems. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This court should reverse and dismiss the trial court's judgment for tortious interference with the contract and business conspiracy for 3 reasons. First, this plaintiff did not have a valid contractual expectancy from these defendants. Second, the parties to the contract cannot tortiously interfere with their own contract. And third, the purported interference in this case could not have caused the alleged breach. Your Honors, this is not a case of good plaintiff, bad defendants, or even vice versa. Rather, this is a case of wrong plaintiff, wrong defendants. Reed Properties, the plaintiff in this case, was the wrong plaintiff because Ford Hand Inc. never conveyed its interest in a leasing fee to Reed Properties. The uncontradicted evidence from the plaintiff at trial was there is a distinct difference between leasing fees and management fees. And what the paragraph 36 of the lease dealt with was a leasing fee and not a management fee. But the trial court and the plaintiff gave short shrift to the actual language of the asset purchase agreement and the assignment in this case, both of which only conveyed management contracts and management fees. There is confusion in this case regarding Exhibit A to the assignment, not to the asset purchase agreement, but to the assignment, which included a description of the property of this particular property in this case. But the assignment specifically said that in the event of a conflict between the assignment and the asset purchase agreement, the terms of the asset purchase agreement shall prevail. And the terms of the asset purchase agreement here were unambiguous. Ford Hand Inc. only conveyed management contracts and management fees. As a result, Ford Hand Inc. was still entitled to collect the leasing fee that was acknowledged in paragraph 36 of the lease. The only question remaining then is who was Ford Hand Inc. entitled to collect those leasing fees from? And the answer has to be Creekside Development Corporation in this case.
Can I ask you this? The plaintiff claimed to be a third-party beneficiary under the agreement, did it not?
Yes, sir.
And that means if that were true, they were, in fact, in law, a party, albeit a third party, to the agreement.
I do not consider them a party. This court held in Restat Construction and Development Corporation that the parties to the contract are the promisor and the promisee, not the third-party beneficiary. And that's what Reed Properties is claiming as a third-party beneficiary. The third-party beneficiary's rights are entirely derivative of the rights of the promisee.
Right. I'm not disagreeing with you on the point. But because of that derivative nature, and because of that, if you want to call it little p party as opposed to big p party, they're governed by the Fox versus Dease rule. And that would be dispositive, would it not?
It would be. Fox versus Dease is dispositive in this case. Your Honor, parties to a contract cannot tortiously interfere with their own contract. And I think that this case, the trial court in this case, improperly applied third-party beneficiary law to tortious interference law. In Fox versus Dease, we have a very similar situation of a scope of employment employee of the city and the city was a party to the contract. The trial court held that the agent's contract is a principal's contract in trying to distinguish Fox versus Dease. But my argument is that there's really no distinction here with the third-party beneficiary, because the third-party beneficiary's contract is the promisee's contract. The third-party beneficiary steps into the shoes of the promisee and essentially enforces the right of the promisee. This court held in Rastek that third-party beneficiary's rights can sink below but cannot rise above the level of the promisee.
And the entirety of the third-party beneficiary's cause of action is contractual in nature, and thus the rule against tortiously interfering with your own contract would be a logical extension.
Yes.
If that's true, would that also kick out civil conspiracy?
Yes. Without the tortious interference with the contract, that was the only predicate unlawful offense in this case, and this court has held numerous times that in order to sustain a claim for statutory business conspiracy, you have to have a predicate unlawful action, which in this case was tortious interference with the contractual expectancy.
Suppose the court were to agree with you that you can't tortiously interfere with your own contract, and therefore the tort is out, but that the evidence is there to support a breach of contract. Should we remand for those damages as opposed to the treble damages, et cetera?
No, Your Honor. And I think the reason is the trial court in this case never actually found a breach of contract in this case. The court found that there was a contractual expectancy, but completely ignored in its final order the breach of contract cause of action. And the appellees did not cross-appeal that issue. That issue is over and done with.
Because that's the thing that seems possibly striking, is that you know, if the evidence, I mean, the evidence shows there was this, I mean, I know you're fighting on the, what the assignment was, but the trial court found otherwise, and so it seems like the evidence points towards a breach of contract, but then strikes me as anomalous that they would walk away with nothing, having proved at a minimum a breach of contract, but...
Your Honor, I do not agree that there was a breach of contract.
No, I'm not asking you to concede that, but assuming that's the case...
Assuming there is a breach of contract, my position is the court should not remand for a judgment on the breach of contract because that issue is not possible.
Well, I'm confused by your position on that because I thought the trial court did find that Reed was a third-party beneficiary of the lease and that Francis and Delta were contractually obligated and committed breaches.
The trial court never actually found that there was a breach in
Well, in the assignments of error 1, 2, and 3 that we refused, you actually asserted that the trial court erred in making those findings.
I did, and I think that was an improvident assertion. After reviewing what this court did on the writ panel denying issues 1, 2, and 3, it became clear to me after reviewing the letter opinion even more that the trial court never actually found that there was a breach. And you can't appeal what the trial court didn't do. Only thing that you can appeal is trial court.
So you've changed your position since you filed the petition?
Correct. I do not believe the trial court found that there was a breach. I don't think that I can appeal that there was a breach. Additionally, Your Honors, the court should reverse and dismiss this case because the tortious interference in this case could not have caused the alleged breach of contract. In this case, the plaintiff alleged that the breach of contract occurred in April of 2014 and then conceded on page 10 of its brief that the course of conduct that gave rise to the tortious interference with the contract claim began after the breach of contract. The claim tortious interference in this case was only the Third Amendment to the lease, which was signed on August 27th of 2014, and the alleged breach happened 5 months before that. The latter could not have caused the former as a matter of law, so the court should reverse and dismiss on that claim as well. Additionally, I'd like to address the contract issues. I know we spent a good deal of time talking about the tort issues, but Francis Hospitality never assumed the obligation of Creekside Development Corporation in this case. Further, the broker's lien statute does not apply in this case. And I think this is a novel issue that the court has never before considered. There's only one case interpreting the broker's lien statute, and then there's a 1998 amendment in the General Assembly that this court has never interpreted before. But the first sentence of Code Section 55.527B still says that the broker's lien shall not attach or be perfected until the recording of a memorandum of such lien. And in Harrison and Bates versus Featherstone Associates, this court emphasized that language, emphasis added when the court cited and quoted subsection B of that code section. And the General Assembly did not change that code section. What the General Assembly did not create an incoherent lien like a mechanics lien. Rather, a fair reading of the statute, including the 1998 amendment, still requires that a broker file a memorandum of broker's lien, and if that memorandum is recorded after the conveyance or transfer of the commercial real estate, the plaintiff has to have actual knowledge of the broker's fees and the lease agreement. The memorandum of broker's lien has never been filed in this case, and the trial court used the broker's lien as the only logical reason why Francis Hospitality would be responsible contract in this case. But the broker suing statute does not modify, abrogate, or change the common law of contracts in that manner. So the second paragraph to subsection B only changes how the broker suing statute is applied, and it allows for the broker suing to be enforced after the conveyance of the property.
That seems kind of like an illusory type of remedy then, right? Because all you have to do is, as these folks did, just engineer some sort of artificial transfer, and then you get out from under the broker's fees, right?
Not necessarily. All the broker would have to do at that point is record a memorandum of broker's lien and file suit to enforce the broker's lien.
Okay.
If you can establish that the purchaser had actual knowledge of the broker's lien, all you have to do is record it and file suit.
Okay.
And Delta Educational Systems is also the wrong defendant in this case because Delta never agreed to pay a leasing fee. The uncontradicted evidence at trial was that Creekside Development, the former landlord, agreed with Ford Gaming to pay a leasing fee of $810 a month. Creekside Development insisted that the leasing fee be paid on a monthly basis, and the monthly fee, that payment arrangement, was insisted on by Creekside out of convenience for Creekside. The evidence is clear that Delta Educational Systems was not a party to that agreement, was not there during that conversation.
May I ask a question about your position that the trial court did not find a breach of contract? In the trial court's letter opinion, it states the course of dealings. No, I find that Delta and Francis Hospitality are jointly liable for the leasing fees. Paragraph 36 provides. And I don't think that's relevant, but Delta was required pursuant to the lease to pay the rent to Caldwell Bank in order for the broker to receive the leasing fees. He says, I find that they were liable for the leasing fees. You're saying that's not a, and they therefore breached the contract when they didn't pay it?
I think what the trial court was doing there was tracking the tortious interference with the contract elements, and he was finding that there was a contractual expectancy.
Well, why wasn't he just dealing with count one of the complaint that was before him?
I don't believe that he was dealing with count one of the complaint, Your Honor. He simply found that they were obligated, but did not find in that paragraph that they breached that agreement. All he found was that they were liable.
That they owed the money. They didn't breach the agreement, they just owed the money. All right.
You're down to 3 minutes. If you'd like to use the rest of it, it's fine, but thought I'd tell you.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for that. Thank you.
Okay, please, the court. I'm Ed Dawson from Lynchburg. I have the pleasure of representing Reed Properties before the court today. I also want to thank the court for allowing the Virginia Realtors Association to file their amicus brief. They have some very important points in their brief that would make this case germane to all of their members and all property owners. Unfortunately, Ms. Foley couldn't be here. She might have a long-standing commitment to a quarterly board meeting. John, this saga began in 2013 when David Francis wanted to purchase a piece of property. It was owned by Creekside Development. That property was subject to a long-standing lease that dated back to 2002. Creekside, the then owner of the property, and Delta Education had entered into a lease for the Millermott School of Business there. And in that lease, in order to compensate the broker that put those parties together, they included paragraph 36. Paragraph 36 of the lease, it is clearly a third-party beneficiary right that was owed to the broker. Paragraph 36, you can find not only in Judge Cook's opinion in the joint appendix at page 58, but also Exhibit 1 in the trial court. That's at the joint appendix at 298.
So let me ask you this then. What logical reason would there be not to apply the Fox principle to a third-party beneficiary to a contract who's suing on a contract? What logic would say we wouldn't do that? Because the whole point of third-party beneficiary law is to place someone in the position of being a de jure party of some sort to the contractual relationship of others.
And I completely agree. The broker was a third-party beneficiary. He was intended third-party beneficiary to that contract. He was supposed to get, or the company was supposed to get, $810 every month when that lease was in effect with all of the amendments and additions to the lease.
All right, so that gets you to your breach of contract. But we generally police the line between contracts and torts. So, I mean, I understand when a third party tries to prevent the contract from being formed or causes some kind of mischief that destroys the contract, an outside party. But here everyone is within the contractual relationship. Why isn't this just a garden variety breach of contract? How does it elevate it to a tort?
Because they're really two different factual scenarios that took place. When David Francis and his company purchased the property in March of 2014, immediately thereafter, even though everybody knew about this broker's fee, immediately thereafter, the payment was not made on the 1st of April. It wasn't made in May. But then the parties to the lease began a different course of conduct. No question that the non-payment constituted the breach. But by entering into the third amendment to the contract, the parties were attempting to completely cut Reed Properties out of their status as a third-party beneficiary. They amended the lease to knock out paragraph 36. That is the tortious interference that we pled and we proved in the trial court.
But a similar scenario happened in Fox versus Deeds. There's always going to be a separate narrative to describe the alleged tort. The point is a principle of law. Torts don't exist based upon contractual relation in the context of contractual relationships, except for some very few exceptions.
And I also would agree with that. But here we had the non-payment beginning in March. And remember, every month is another breach of that contract. But what they did is not just breach the contract, they tried to do away with the contractual obligation.
May I interrupt you again? You've heard a lot of the questions from us about the nature of the contractual claim. And I just have to ask you straight up, why didn't the appellee brief come in and say, look, I went on all the tort things, but even if I don't, I still get the $34,000 that I wanted on count one? Why wasn't that argued, or maybe it's there and I overlooked it, and please point it out if it is.
Well, I think that it is there by virtue of what this court did on the petition for appeal. Those contract issues were before the court. I think Judge Cook, in his opinion, clearly he says, I'm going to address each of the three causes of action, and in the first in his first decision, he held that the parties were jointly liable under the breach of contract theory. He then went on to discuss the tortious interference claim and then the conspiracy.
I don't disagree. That's a very reasonable interpretation. Of what I don't quite understand is the appellee brief doesn't say that. The appellee brief doesn't say, look, no matter what, I get the $34,000.
I think we do say that by saying that the contract issues are... they've been decided.
So we wouldn't, under your perspective, we wouldn't remand it to sort out the contract breach, or we would just do what? Give you the $34,000? Because there was no holding that $34,000 was actually the contract damages amount. It's just, as you point out, and some of our questions imply, the contractual breach is implicit in the opinion, but there's no causation analysis, there's no damage analysis. So what would you ask us to do in that scenario?
I think under the only issues before this court are the tortious interference and the conspiracy count. I think we've already won on the contract issue. That issue has been decided. This court did not grant the request to appeal those issues, didn't grant those assignments of error. So I think under the law of the case, the contract issues have been decided in their favor.
So again, what would our order say? Remand for entry of $34,000? We just picked the number that you had in your addendum?
And because those were the uncontradicted damages that were addressed to the trial.
Right, because the court found those damages and then trebled them. So all we do is divide by three.
Right.
If assuming we don't buy the tortious interference
theory. The $34,000 worth of, those were the amount of payments that were remaining under the contract here. The court then trebled that amount.
Right, and then tacked on attorney's fee. Right.
and appearance is a completely separate factual scenario. But it, as I told the trial court, had this Third Amendment not been prepared and sent to us as part of the discovery in the general district court, we wouldn't be here. But clearly, Delta Education knew that there was something wonky going on with that scenario, because Francis Hospitality approached the lessee and said, let's sign this Third Amendment. And Delta said, well, I'll do that, but only if we are completely indemnified. The general counsel, whose deposition was offered at trial, he understood the concepts of tortious interference, conspiracy, and that was the reason that they required that indemnity agreement to be signed before Delta would agree to sign on to this Third Amendment.
So, but a consequence of that would be, if someone just stops performing or paying or whatever, there's this just a breach of contract. But if you start talking to others about breaching, then what would otherwise be a garden variety breach of contract transmogrifies into a tort with conspiracy, treble damages, etc. So, and maybe that's where we end up. But it seems odd that because they're conferring and talking with other folks who are in within the intendment of the contract, it springs into a tort.
Well, the distinction that I would make, and I would urge on this court, is that the discussion was not about let's continue this breach. The discussion was let's amend the lease. Let's obviate the obligation that we have to make these payments. As a defense to the general district breach of contract case, let's completely do away with the obligation.
So let's come up with a new contract among ourselves that'll ice out the broker.
Cuts out the broker completely. And that's the point that the Virginia Realtors Association is making, that even though you confer a third-party beneficiary status on someone, two parties agree to benefit the third-party beneficiary, it would throw out the whole line of third-party beneficiary law to let those two parties go in and say, yeah, that's what we agreed to do initially, but we're going to change all of that.
Well, that's what the breach of contract claim is for. It doesn't throw out the law. You sue them in contract, and you get your $34,000, and you move on.
That is a possibility. But under this scenario...
Well, it seems like it was a probability because you apparently won $34,000 in the lower court.
We did. But I still make the distinction that non-payment was the breach. That's the contractual side of the case. But when they got together and completely did away with the obligation, not let's not pay, but let's do away with Reed Properties' status as a third-party beneficiary, they are specifically interfering with Reed Properties' rights under that contract.
Well, but under your theory, what we have to do is make an exception now for third-party beneficiaries in the law of tortious interference, right?
I mean, well, I still think you need three people. You still need either an outside interferer, and I'm not aware of any case that this court or any other court has decided that says that interferer needs to be a stranger to the contract. That is a point that is offered to this court by my colleague, but I don't see any support in the law for that. Now, they talk about third parties. They talk about needing a third party to be the interferer. But what Judge Cook ruled, and what I believe, is that Delta interfered with the obligation that Francis had to Reed Properties, and Francis Hospitality interfered with Delta's obligation.
But all three are part of the same contractual transaction. I mean, if the parties got together and it recorded among them saying, you know what, let's tortiously interfere with this contract. Let's just do that. The answer would be, well, if you're parties to the contract, there's no such thing. It doesn't exist. You just have a breach of contract. That's what Fox versus Deese says, does it not?
Well, and when you read the Fox versus Deese case, there's language in there that says, it's the Chavez case, which then talks about the Fox case. It talks about a third-party beneficiary whose rights have been interfered with, and that tortious interference, intentional interference, is an appropriate cause of action under that scenario. It doesn't require a stranger to the contract to be the interviewer. Clearly, I think the judge's letter opinion dealt with the contract issue. That issue is not before the court. There was a valid contract, and that issue was not taken up by this court. We think that all of the four elements of tortious interference were met in the trial court. There was the existence of a valid contractual relationship that was found by the trial court. And certainly there was knowledge on the part of each of the two interferors. They were parties to it, and David Francis, when he got into attempting to purchase this piece of property, he was told about the lease fee. He did everything he could to negotiate away, and negotiated away, but was unsuccessful. His broker finally told him that this fee is just like insurance and taxes. It's something that you're going to have to pay. If you don't want to pay it, then don't buy the property. There's no question that their agreement, the Third Amendment to the contract, is what caused the termination of the relationship with Reed Properties as the third-party beneficiary, and certainly the damage was the non-payment of the fee. So clearly, we believe that the four elements of tortious interference were proven at the trial court level. And under the Dunlap case, that serves as the improper or illegal act, which serves as the basis for the conspiracy. So once you show the intentional interference, then we certainly have the elements of the conspiracy. They combine to injure the properties in their business. And I think for this court to throw out this concept, to not sustain the verdict of the trial court, would, in essence, turn the real estate world on its ear. And that's what was set forth in the amicus brief. So I would ask the court to affirm the decision from below and let us have a verdict.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Plaintiff's theory, the parties to a contract can never amend a contract when it affects a third-party beneficiary. But the law of contracts allows the parties to decide how their contracts will be amended, and that's exactly what the parties in this case did. Paragraph 33 of the lease expressly allowed for the parties to the contract to amend the lease. There were two prior amendments to the lease before the third amendment in August of 2014. And the first one extended the lease for 5 years. The second one extended the lease for another 5 years. The broker or the third-party beneficiary never signed those amendments to the lease. The broker or the third-party beneficiary is not given veto power over what the parties want to do to their lease. So it's the equivalent of saying that a beneficiary of a will who also happens to be a third-party beneficiary can prevent a parent from changing their will at some point before they die. Third-party beneficiary does not have the power to veto what the parties to a contract.
Is $34,000 the right number for the breach of contract claim?
That's what the plaintiff claimed, but again, the trial court never found that those were the damages in this case. And I think it's an interesting point that my colleague makes on oral argument that each month is its own separate breach of contract, but that's not what the plaintiff argued at the trial court. The trial court claimed, the plaintiff argued, and the trial court agreed that it was an anticipatory breach. The trial was in January of 2017. I believe the order was entered in March or April of 2017, but the damages were strewn out to September of 2017.
Well, suppose for the sake of argument, without conceding anything, that the lower court's opinion subsumed a breach of contract finding, else the tortious interference with the expectancy didn't exist. Two, we refuse the assignment of error challenging that. Three, it's not before us today. What's the remedy from your perspective without agreeing to any of those predicates I just established? What is the proper remedy from your perspective?
Without conceding any of those points, I would suggest the court that would reverse affirm in part and award damages in amount of $34,000. Again, not conceding the fact that Francis Hospitality never assumed that obligation. The broker saying did not create that obligation. Delta never agreed to that obligation, Creekside did, and Reed Properties never obtained the rights to leasing fees from the Board campaign. But the leasing fee is entirely different than a management fee in the management contract, which did not exist on this property. For all of those reasons, Your Honor, we ask the court to reverse and dismiss this case. Thank you.
Call the next case.